Yes Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games, where I interview creators about their games and inspirations, and about the theory, process and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, your host today and always, and your friendly local indie enthusiast. This week, I'm bringing you my final interview for Yes Indeed Pod, with games journalist, playwright and designer Thomas Manuel, who, as you hopefully know, will be the new host and producer for Yes Indeed Pod. It's a great interview which definitely showcases Thomas's nous and chops, so I'm stoked to finally share it with you. Now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. So, today we're talking to Thomas Manuel. Hi there, Thomas, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Max. Nice to be here.
Very much so. Well, you better get used to it. Thomas, would you like to take a minute to introduce yourself and let us know what you do in indie tabletop role-playing games?
Yeah. I'm Thomas Manuel. I'm an Indian game designer. I work as a journalist. I worked as a playwright. And now I also design games. And I also now podcast, or will be podcasting in the immediate future.
Absolutely. Thomas, I think most people know you in that kind of journalistic role in the indie scene. You run a pretty popular newsletter. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
So I run the indie RPG newsletter. It's the main thing I do in the tabletop space, and I started it around 2 years ago. I think roughly when Yes Indeed started, if I'm not wrong.
Ooh.
I think we've been roughly going for around the same time.
I started in January 2020.
January 2020?
Yeah, that was definitely the first month.
I started around August 2020, I think. So,
there is
a gap there. I just marked the 2 year anniversary, so that's like, you know, 100 issues kind of a
fantastic.
The newsletter is a sort of weekly roundup of interesting like articles, podcasts, media, anything I find would be interesting to someone who follows indie RPGs but is not on Twitter as much as I am. And then I usually kind of add a little bit of my own as well at the top.
That's kind of where my question was coming from, because pretty soon none of us will be on Twitter as much as we are now. So I was talking to Cesar Capacle about this last week. We're all thinking about this, but like, what are we going to do in terms of promotion and advertising in a post Twitter world? And a lot of people are saying, well, let's all have newsletters. So what are your top tips for writing a successful indie TTRPG newsletter?
Honestly, I don't think there is anything super useful that I could say. It has been, you know, 2 years of me kind of doing this, and I haven't missed a week really. So my real strength is consistency. Like, it might not be the best newsletter, but it's pretty damn regular.
I mean, of the newsletters I receive, I think it's the most comprehensive and interesting, and it's always a good roundup of what's been happening in the last week or so, discourse aside. So I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah, thank you so much. I know you also now do a newsletter, the Far Horizons newsletter.
I feel like that's so cheating because I don't put all of that together. I mean, I'd like to emulate your style because I think you have this really interesting overview of something that you're interested in talking about. Like, at the moment you're doing your series about cities, which is really fascinating, and then you always have really interesting links to go and check out and podcasts and videos to watch and things like that. And yeah, it's just a really good summary of what the scene feels like, which I think is probably quite hard to do. So, you know, if you're finding it easy and fun, then good for you.
It is work. Like, I will not downplay the amount of work it is. But yeah, it is fun. And it is something that, you know, sort of like when I decided to start talking about games, when I kind of wanted to like participate in the conversation in general, the only place to do it that I found was Twitter, and Twitter was terrifying. Like, Twitter was genuinely scary to talk on, because I think the platform structurally kind of creates this space where you're constantly like misunderstanding other people. Like, thoughtfulness is not prioritized structurally. So I need to make some space where I can talk about games. And then I thought about the newsletter because it's something I have done in my other kind of journalistic work.
Yeah.
Then I came up on this idea of like curation and stuff like that because you want to be useful. That's where I came from. I was like, I would love a platform and a space to talk about games and to just think about games publicly and, you know, have a conversation about games. But I would also really, really like for it to be like useful to other people as well. And, you know, and I'm walking that line well.
I think you definitely are. And like, it's really interesting that you say that you found Twitter terrifying to begin with. And that's why you wanted a more hands-off approach, I guess. You know, you don't get this back and forth conversation with a newsletter. I mean, is that something that appeals?
I'm not against back and forth conversation. I think I would, you know, in fact, the newsletter is a bit too one-sided sometimes. You know, it also feels like, you know, kind of just, you know, you send an email and nobody replies. Like, I mean, you get like analytics and stuff like that. So you know how many people opened it and things like that. But
but
every time someone comments and things, you go like, oh, okay, good. Someone is reading it.
Yeah.
It does feel a lot safer to some extent because nobody is, you know, kind of like misreading you. Like they know where the unsubscribe button is. Like this is a choice that people are making. You're not inflicted upon them.
There's a lot of that around at the moment. People are like a bit scared to jump ship and start on a new social media platform, for instance. And maybe it's just this kind of reticence and this feeling that, oh, everybody is going to be all up in my grill all the time and, you know, up against me. And actually, I think once you've sort of established yourself and found your little niche and found like the people you want to listen to, most social media is a little less frightening. But that hands-off approach as well is really good. Another thing you mentioned there is about being a playwright. Do you think there's kind of quite a good synergy between being a game designer specifically, but also just generally playing role-playing games and that act of creation for the stage?
That's a super interesting question. And I think if you're talking about play in general, I think there is that kind of cliche of the theater kid, you know, who's into RPGs and the way they play. And I hadn't
thought of that, but okay.
No, there is. I mean, and like, I think the first thing to note is that the theater kids have been playing role-playing games as long as the Wargamers, right? Like, you know, if John Peterson's book kind of reveals this fact that, you know, when D&D first came out, like nobody knew how to play it and they weren't kind of talking to each other as they figured it out. So you had all these scenes kind of making up their own version of D&D. And many of those scenes were, you know, theater adjacent scenes, writing adjacent scenes, you know, like science fiction clubs and things like that. And the way they played the game was different from the people who were coming to it, having played a bunch of like war games.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's about play. But about design specifically, I think there is something there. I think there are a few theater people in the design space. I know Tyler Crumrain was a dramaturg and maybe is a dramaturg, I don't know, of possible world games.
That sounds correct,
and,
yes.
There are other folks. And like there are some overlaps in terms of when you think about like designing like interactions and things like that. But my role in the theater was writing. And I think that is the common link, just this kind of desire to like create an experience. Like I think that is the connecting link, but it's very, very different forms of creating an experience, I think.
Do you think that's because for one of them, you're creating an experience for a, you know, quite a personal audience, and the other one is a like sort of one way impersonal audience, if you like?
I definitely think the unique part of role-playing games, the most unique part, is the fact that you are like author and audience like at the same time, like when you play.
That
is an amazing feeling, and definitely that's what kind of like appeals to me. When I tried to do theater, it was a lot of work, involved a lot of people, it involves a stage. It took a long time to get to that place where you can just, you know, have that experience. And with games, it feels like you do it much more casually and much more messily, and that's the good part.
That is the good part, yeah. I mean, I don't know how out of vogue this is now, but I bought a book a while ago because it had amazing marginalia, which was Augusto Boal's Games for Actors and Non-Actors. And like, Augusto Boal is dramatic theorist and philosopher who created this style of theater called Theater of the Oppressed, which is astounding. But when you read it, it's like, this is what role-playing games are. This is having a conversation between actors and non-actors, to use the parlance. And it feels very much like in trying to engage role-playing game aspects in theatre in general, and that's interesting to me. You know, yeah. It's kind of interesting to hear you say that actually you feel like, to your mind at least, there's a lot of separation between your work as a playwright and your work as a game designer.
It's a question of distance, right? If you're like really close to it, a small distance feels quite large. But if you're looking from far away, a small distance can look quite infinitesimal. So like,
okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's interesting in itself, isn't it? That like, I can look at a different world and say, oh yeah, that looks a bit like role-playing, and then when you're actually there, it's like, oh no, you're wrong, that doesn't look like role-playing at all. And that's kind of on me, isn't it? To kind of stop treating everything as a nail because I've got this hammer of role-playing games.
It's a neat hammer, it's a neat tool to kind of like look at everything else by, like, you know, instead of looking at role-playing games and going like, oh, they're like, you sit at a table and make up a movie, instead you look at a movie and you go like, what kind of game is this? Like, what kind of,
yeah, that's a game? Curse, isn't it? Yeah. It's the curse of the game designer. And yeah. I think to a lesser extent, like, every role player is like that. You know, they'll watch Star Wars and think, oh, you know, I could do that 10 times better. But it comes to it and like, it's just Monty Python jokes and, you know. Tell me about your game design practice. What have you been working on? What do people know you for?
Again, I've been kind of designing just roughly as long as I've been doing the newsletter. So again, I think about 2 years. My first game was a game called The Spider and the City, which I still kind of really love. It's a solo game that kind of mechanically draws on sort of just the engagement role of Blades in the Dark. Like, just, I was like, oh, what if you were just answering some questions and making a dice pool and then you'd roll it and then you just know how everything kind of like worked out. There's a lineage to that, more definitely older than Blades, but that's where I was kind of coming from. So it combines this sort of like tactical, like building a dice pool and then kind of rolling it with journaling. And it's a game about a criminal mastermind in a rebel city. So the idea is the city has just kind of overthrown its government and is in full-scale revolt, and there is an army marching towards the city to retake it. But for now, in this moment, the people are free and they're kind of governing themselves. And you know, you used to be a criminal in the old world. You were kind of working against the system. Now what are you going to be like in this new order? And it's, you know, I thought that was a very like an interesting question, and I'm still fascinated by cities. Like, the joke how often my games have the word city like in them in the title. But yeah, and I was kind of like thinking, inspired by like Barcelona during the Spanish Civil War and moments like that where cities were kind of ruling themselves, and I was like, okay,
the Paris Commune,
Paris Commune is the big one. Yeah,
I think I understand the fascination with cities, because a country is a hard thing to look at. Every country has so much to it, you know, so many different cities, so many different parts, and all of them will feel very different. And yet a city is kind of, that's an approachable level of space. I can feel like I'd be able to walk across a city. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I could probably see 90% of the parts of a city and yet none of it in a single day, you know? And I think that's fascinating.
There's this kind of split in fantasy, right? Like, I mean, if you think of like Western fantasy as beginning with Tolkien, who was, you know, focused on the countryside, it was kind of anti-industrialist, saw machines and industry as sort of like destroying this sort of like pristine natural world that used to exist. A lot of writers that came after, people like Michael Moorcock once wrote an essay about Tolkien titled Epic Poo or something like that. But, you know, people like China Mirville, who are sort of like, what is a fantasy that kind of breaks away from that tradition? And one of the key things was like, it's going to be urban. With all that means, like, you know, cities are like complex spaces, but we'll set it in an urban space. And that, like, that one decision makes such a big break from the kind of fantasy that came before. So I am still, I think a lot of this is like stuff that happened in like the 60s or whatever, but I'm still kind of like still there just thinking about, okay, what kind of things do you imagine doing in it? I mean, because I'm a city boy. Are you a city person?
I grew up, like, I could walk to the city center from where I used to live, but it was a small city, and now I live on the outskirts of it. I think I have a different fascination. I have a fascination with the edges of cities, and like, where does the city become the countryside and where does the countryside become the city? And I think that's a really interesting space. That's a weird space as well. That's a kind of meeting of two completely different styles, and lots of weird stuff happens there, which I talked a lot to Eco from The Lost Bay about, because yeah. we both have this kind of suburban upbringing. That fascination with the city, I think, is really interesting, because I guess cyberpunk is the kind of massive archetype of what that could ultimately look like. That's just about cities. You don't see cyberpunk adventures happening in the countryside, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you
is
should.
That ultimately
now
where
that
we're headed?
You've said it, like...
But no, I'm not really a city person. So I like to be there for a short time, and I like to think that I can explore it, but I guess that's also not something that a person can do. But what I'm really saying is that actually, maybe, when we talk about cities, a city is a lot like a country, and like every different part of a city is like a different part of a country, and you can't know any one of them better than another unless you live in it. Maybe that's what I feel.
I think that's true of spaces in general. But yeah, I mean, definitely yeah. there is this thing about the city being a level of complexity that is nice to deal with. Like when you get to countries, like I know my politics makes thinking about countries like very messy. Nationalism and things like that. I don't know what I want to say about that in games. And
there's another aspect which somebody mentioned to me probably 10 years ago, and that was to say that actually cities are dynamic and they can move a lot quicker than a country can move. They can move a lot quicker than a culture can move. And that's really important if you're talking about things like, you know, massive things that doesn't feel like you can make a big change, but like a city can make quite a big change in terms of climate change and things like that. That's really interesting. And if all the cities in the world decided unanimously that they were going to do a thing independently, more or less, from their own governments, then like that would be an enormous change that would mobilize such a huge number of people in one direction. And I think there's a lot to be said for governance from a lower level. Who could have guessed that I would have said such a thing? I think what you're talking about in terms of cities and rebellion with the spider in the city, that sounds very much like a really interesting and fascinating space to look at. Maybe people should go and check that out. That sounds really cool to me.
You know, I've been thinking about it constantly. Like you said, like I, on the newsletter, I've been kind of like reading these city settings to kind of figure out what designers have been, when they sit down to write a city, what do they think is important for their players? Like I don't know what's important about a city to put down yeah. on paper. So I just wanted to figure out what other people are doing. And it is really interesting. Like one thing, for example, is like people write cities that are kind of horrible to live in. Like this is when you write a fantasy city, it's going to be a terrible place. And it's one of those things which confuses me, because I'm like, why do people live here? Like, you know, like this is not...
That's it. I feel like a lot of this happens in world building. Like you either build a utopia or you build a crap sack world, you know? It's not... There aren't places like... I grew up in Nottingham. You don't find places like Nottingham in role-playing games, because like fundamentally they're very boring. And actually, like, would you write a role-playing game about Milton Keynes? It would be very specific, you know? Like, I don't feel like most of the places that people live are either 100% fantastic or 100% awful and terrible.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm calling for less homogeneity in city building, you know?
It just comes from that sense of like, if I'm designing a playground, like everything has to be a ride. And that is,
yeah, okay.
What are players going to do in this world except deal with danger on every side kind of thing? So yeah.
That's true. If you build a violent role-playing game, like the most fun things that you can do with it are go out and hit things. So I guess it's a method of incentives. I don't know, maybe that does apply more widely. Like I'm thinking of Wanderhome now, and like on the outside that looks like quite an idyllic kind of setting. I know, like practically speaking, it's not, but that generally reinforces the feeling of play, which is non-violence and a kind of more introspective wandering through a landscape.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm thinking of a game like Barbarians of Lemuria. The world that it's built around is like horribly violent and everything wants to kill you, and consequently your characters are
horribly violent and they want to kill everything. And yeah. like all of these things sort of feed back on each other and reinforce each other. I'm trying to think of some of the cities that you've looked at, and one of them is Dusk Bowl. And that is a city that's very dark and quite violent. Yeah. And consequently, the actions that it encourages you to go and take are quite dark and quite violent.
Yeah, exactly. Duskfall is a city that was kind of designed for you to be a scoundrel in, you know? Like,
yeah.
That is good design if that's what you were kind of intending to do. You know, it's not a criticism of games that, you know, they make cities like this. If that is what they intended, at least, like, I respect the vision, right? Yeah.
But it would be weird to set out to make a game where you were trying to make hopeful and meaningful connections between humans in one of these crap sack cities, right? That yeah, wouldn't absolutely. Necessarily make sense. Although now I'm also really fascinated to try that. So
that's the thing, right? Like, another interesting thing about cities or games that try to make cities is like, how much effort did they put into whether you can make a home in this place? Like, can you carve out a corner here that you connect to and that you want to protect because you're integrated into it? And that is also like a rare thing. I think Duskfall doesn't do too bad a job of that, actually. Some other places definitely do a bad job where, like, you have this city with all this lore, but you'll always be a tourist in it, right? Like, because everything is out yes. to get you, and you think of everything kind of like instrumentally. You're just trying to extract, you know, some kind of value out of it.
I think what Duskfall does well is it shows that people, real people, live in that city,
yeah.
which is what other city settings that I've looked at or played in, just like, it feels like they're a world in the Star Wars universe, you know, that it's just that whole planet does one thing only. So that whole city just is there to, I don't know, serve some kind of criminal underworld. And like, Duskfall doesn't feel like that because it's been intelligently written.
Yeah.
It's got multiple biomes.
It's that. And it's also the fact that people have a reason to live in Duskfall. And the reason is they can't live anywhere else.
They can't live anywhere else. That's also true. That's a good point. Yeah. You know, you have to build your home there. Otherwise, you'll be eaten by hungry ghosts. Yeah. Spoilers of Blade in the Dark. What are some of the other games that you've got in your back catalogue at the moment?
Yeah, I have a game that I kind of worked on for a bit last year, sort of called Hyper City.
Oh, no, not again.
yeah, exactly. This is, like, it's painful, like, how unconsciously I did this. This is a game, this is sort of, it's a hack of Iron Swan. It's a cyberpunk okay. game. It's a solo game, so you are kind of, you wake up, you don't remember who you are, and you are exploring the city trying to figure that out. But the kind of cool thing about it is that I try to design something where you play it solo, but you play in a shared world with other people. So you are locked into one city, you pick a real city from the real world that you kind of know something about or want to play in, and then you make a cyberpunk version of that city, and then that's where your game is set. And your friend could pick another city, and you could be in the same world, and you could talk to each other through this in-game forum called SeekerNet. Because you're all seekers and you're on SeekerNet. So there's like mechanics in the game for you kind of like asking a question and another player kind of answering it. And then you kind of putting that into your game and stuff like that.
That's so cool.
It's a cool
really
idea.
That. Yeah. That's really cool. Wow.
Yeah.
I love solo games that think about a specific topic like that, you know, that think about cities. Because it gives you a really interesting space to go out and play in. Like, when I play solo games, I choose a city in the world like that because it's a fun space to explore, and it's nice to remember these places that I've been in the past as well, or haven't and would just like to go to, and I'm really interested in that.
Yeah.
So that's Hyper City. That sounds cool. Yeah. When did that come out? Was that sometime last year?
So that I kind of did this playtest version a long time ago. I don't quite remember, but it just like a few months ago, I kind of polished it up and published the sort of like 64-page condensed like rule set, which has everything you need to play. And that's a game I'm quite proud of as well, just because like Iron Swan is a big game to like hack, to like wrestle with. It has so much. And
you're telling me. It's there on my shelf glaring at me like I am one of the biggest books you have on your shelf. Why are you not playing me? Yeah, I love Iron Swan. What I really like are the hacks the Fallen outfit because they just feel raw. It's a good space to hack. It's a really interesting space to hack in a way that is more targeted, I think, than PBTA and FITD. You know, it's just a very interesting mechanical space to explore. I think there's lots of moving parts that you can mess around with, and that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great game. It's also like a great book.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's just,
yeah.
It was well conceptualized and executed. Like, I think, like, a lot of games, it's so hard to, like, pick up the book and, like, actually, like, figure out how to play. But you can do that with Iron Sword. Like, you can read the book and yeah. You will learn how to play. And I think that's a part of why it became such a big success, because a lot of people didn't get PBTA or wouldn't have got it. And this was the first PBTA game they picked up, and they learned how to play it from the book. Is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very pedagogical in a way. Yeah, you know, it tells you. It's not vague. It's very targeted. It very much says what you need to do if you want to play this game, and also highlights what's optional and what's mandatory. And it just works really well. And it's nice that you can explore it solo as well as in other modes. And it's just very well designed. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for Sean Tomkin, and I know he's a listener. So thank you for making a cool game, Sean. Yeah. So do you have any projects lined up for the future that aren't journalism for games?
Game-wise, I'm working on one game that I'm super excited about. It's called Depths Unfathomable. It's sort of a post-apocalyptic game where you play divers who dive into this sort of like sacred river and recover salvage. And then you figure out what to do with that salvage, right? It's a game about like deciding how much of the old world you can use and you can keep, and how much of it needs to stay buried or be destroyed.
Is that a solo game as well, or is that more?
No, that's a bigger experience. A game that is kind of loosely forged in the dark, but this specific flavor comes from Galen Peugeot. Galen's game Crash Cart, which is a card-based game of Forged in the Dark. And I really loved Crash Card. It was my game of the year last year.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been messing around with that system.
Crash Card's the cyberpunk ambulance drivers.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. You play EMTs.
You know, this is really weird. I may be thinking of a different game, but like when I was in the Forged in the Dark Google Plus group,
okay.
which I guess is nearly 10 years ago now, I remember a person telling me that they were going to make a Forged in the Dark game about EMTs in a cyberpunk world. So, wow. I'm amazed it's finally come out.
If that was Galen, then yeah.
And I hope I have remembered this anecdote correctly, because otherwise it's a really boring one. But, you know, that's Depths Unfathomable. Do you have a kind of vague idea of timeline for that, or are we going to be looking for that into the future?
Yeah, so the cool part about this game is that, you know, I had a skeleton, then I started playtesting it, and I, through playtests, am, you know, building more of the game out. Like, it is being kind of, like, designed in concert with the playtests, and that's a really nice feeling. It is the most communal and social way I have designed till now. So, yeah,
that sounds really cool.
Yeah, I don't know when that's going to come out, but...
But sometime.
At some point, and you know, because I'm still having fun with it, I'm not in a rush to, to get it over.
Yeah, well, look out for Depths Unfathomable, and go and look at Hyper City and The Spider in the City, and also sign up to Thomas Manuel's amazing newsletter, the Indie TTRPG newsletter, which is very cool. Thomas, do you want to tell us where we can find you on the internet?
Yeah, that's a hard question.
It's the $44 billion question, shall we say.
Yeah, but...
I'm on it tonight, yeah.
The thing that is definitely going to be available is, you know, my newsletter, which is at ttrpg.substack.com. That's a nice, clean...
Nice link. One, yeah.
that you can get, that you can go to. And as you know, as far as social media is concerned, I'm on everything at the moment. We'll see which of those survive, yeah.
Mastodon, co-host, Hive, which one is which? All the same. Yeah. But yeah, if we can find you, we'll find you, I'm sure. Yeah. And I guess all that remains for me to say is thank you very much for coming on Yes Indeed Pod. and fantastically good luck with Yes Indeed Pod, I guess. I mean,
yeah, I'm really excited. I've been thinking about guests and things like
fantastic.
That already.
Yeah, well, yeah, just good luck with it. I'm going to carry on listening.
I mean, I'm really excited to continue it because I think you made something really special and I just want it to exist. And, you know, thank you for trusting me with the reins. I think that means a lot.
You know. That's fine. I'm glad someone wanted them.
Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Thomas for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. Next time, in what is absolutely the final time I'll be on Yes Indeed Pod, we're turning the tables around and having Thomas interview yours truly. I can confirm that it was a bittersweet interview to be involved with, and I'm really excited to finally share it with you. Tune in very shortly to find out more. This week, I'd like to thank all of my incredible Patreon supporters. Samantha Lee, Sam Armstrong, Carl Rigney, Thomas Elliott, Craig Duffy, Dono McCarthy, Hesan Yongdi, Beyond Cataclysm, Peter Ike, Jack Blair, and Tentacle Duck. Thank you all so, so much. Your patronage has meant the world to me since we first started asking for donations. And you, yes, you can get a regular shout out and joyful thanks too if you go to patreon.com/yesindeedpod and sign up today. You'll get access to our Discord server where we can hang out and chat, and even join monthly editing streams and the Yes Indeed Pod book club. Most of the money will go directly to creators rather than to me, so you'll be investing directly in the indie scene, helping to make it a healthy and inclusive place for years to come. And if you can't commit regularly, you can always help out by rating and reviewing the show wherever you find your podcasts, or by donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at yesindeedpod. That's YesIndeedPod. I'd love dearly to hear from you. Lastly, music credits. All music is taken from Be Quiet by Yatza, from the Free Music Archive, released under Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 International License. Thanks, Yatza. Until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.